Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead this hour, the pandemic has overwhelmed hospitals and those who work there. We'll check in with a recent nursing school graduate about her experience in her new career. In some places, people who test positive for COVID are told to notify their close contacts, but many are confused and say there's a lack of guidance. An East Central Illinois pastor and his wife decided against getting the vaccine.
It was uncertainty. We knew it needed to be done, but I think every member of the family was like a little uneasy about the shot.
Then his wife died from COVID. We'll hear his message now. And the tragic deaths of DCFS employees in the field. We'll talk with a former caseworker who now trains those who do the job. Those stories and more on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Earlier this month, a Department of Children and Family Services caseworker went out to make a child welfare check in Sangamon County. She wound up dead. Authorities say Deidre Silas was stabbed. A suspect is in custody. The case spotlights the dangers associated with the job. Silas went through a training program that uses a simulated setting to prepare caseworkers. They go to a house at the University of Illinois Springfield where actors provide different scenarios. The organizer of that training says it's vital, but that more needs to be done to protect those who are going on these calls. Betsy Goulet is director of the Alliance for Exponential Problem-Based Learning at UIS, and she's worked in child protection for more than three decades. We had a chance to speak with her.
If there's an audience or a group of people who perhaps think that I sit in my office or my classroom or that I just do research without having any actual experience in the field, my tenure in the field was very, very brief, but I started working as an investigator for DCFS many, many years ago. As hard as that work was, as much of a toll as it takes on you emotionally and physically, I do not regret a day that I spent in the field for the perspective it gave me and the empathy that I still have to this day for the workforce. And I think it influences everything that I do professionally.
What should somebody think about if they are looking to go into that career? I would think it takes a special type of person to be able to do that on a day-in, day-out basis.
It does. And I don't know that there's one set of skills that we could put on a checklist, and then as we're training a new class where we could eliminate people because they don't have one or two of these skills. I think that the most important reflection or awareness is for the person who wants to do this work. And this is where I think simulation becomes so critical, that when they get into that environment that we put them in, where they're interacting with the family members, you know, who are actually standardized patients from our School of Medicine who take on the roles of family members, their ability to really assess what it felt like for them and to sit in that for a while and determine if they can really see themselves doing the work. I wonder to this day, having now been involved in this training work for nearly 6 years, whether that would have created a real challenge for me. If I had been in simulation, would I have perhaps opted out and gotten a job at Barnes & Noble in the safety of the books, rather than going into the field, making very, very critical decisions for children and their families?
You mentioned the simulation training, and you provide that at University of Illinois Springfield. You provide that for the state agency, but also even for other states. I've seen it in action before, but for those that haven't, what really takes place in that simulation training?
You know the story of the little house that had sat vacant for many years out in the cornfield, as we like to say. And so that house, I was very familiar with it. I knew its history. I knew that it had at one point been the childcare center. I had gone through a training in Minnesota that was geared for the design and implementation of simulation training for students so that they could have a better sense of what it takes to work with families in crisis, and primarily really focused on child protection. So I had my eyes on that house and was still surprised that it had never been torn down, frankly. And so truly believed that it was just waiting for us to repurpose it, which we were allowed to do. And then about that time had made a pitch to DCFS, you know, what would child protection training look like if it had a simulation component? Just about every other industry utilizes simulation. You know, you wouldn't get on an airplane if you didn't know for a fact that your pilot had spent months in simulation training, or your doctor, you know, getting ready to do an appendectomy. That kind of training prepares professionals to be able to do the work. And yet we were sending child protection investigators to knock on doors having never done that, never practiced it. So we literally teach them how to do just that, knock on the door.
They go in and it's really, you have actors who are involved in this?
Right. And there are scenarios that we create from composites of real cases that often had bad outcomes. So we learn from those and we create these stories that allow the trainee to step into the environment where there are clear risks. Sometimes people come into the house and say, this is kind of over the top. You know, there's a lot of stuff going on in the house. And when I say that, I mean, there are situations in the house, there are props, there are things that would be troubling, red flags. And we have to have a lot of them because we only have the trainees for a week. So we have to create as many things that generate that response that they have to ask about, that they have to determine, does this risk need to be mitigated and in what way? And can a child safely live in this environment based on the allegations that we have? So there's a lot of stuff going on. In simulation training, it's often so, it happens so quickly or it feels like it took forever, but the worker often doesn't remember much of what was said because there's so much going on in that moment. So the debrief becomes really critical to their understanding of how the family member felt. And so the actor debriefs in character and will speak to the trainee from their role as the mom or the alleged perpetrator. And they will say, when you didn't even make eye contact with me, I felt like you were dismissing me, felt like you didn't care what I was going through today. That's pretty profound. You know, they're not going to forget that feeling of having a family member talk to them like that. Sometimes the trainees just have a momentary, quick reaction in the house, and the actor will say, you rolled your eyes at me, or you turned your back on me. And the trainee's really surprised that that happened, or the impact that it had on the parent. So those are things you can't do in a lecture. And then we expanded in 2019, created another sim lab in Chicago in partnership with DCFS. And now the model is going to be expanded into Carbondale and into a northern location in partnership with NIU. So Illinois has invested in this. Illinois is committed to this model. And the more we learn, the more opportunities we've had on the national level to present about it and share what we have learned with other states.
We're talking with Betsy Goulet, Director of the Alliance for Experiential Problem-Based Learning with the University of Illinois Springfield. We're talking about DCFS and training of caseworkers. Betsy, certainly we had a very tragic case in Sangamon County just recently, and this is the second time something like this has occurred in the state in just the last few years. We had a caseworker who went to a home doing a child welfare check, and according to the authorities, she was stabbed and died. A suspect has been arrested in that. I know you don't know all the details of this case. A lot of those still have not come out, but your thoughts on when you hear something like this?
I have a lot of reactions. So the whole team, the Child Protection Training Academy team, this really hit hard. You know, you asked me about doing this work, and that was in the late 80s that I did this, and it doesn't look much different in 2022. And yet, you know, a lot of us have said over the years, it's just not safe. You know, in so many of the cases, the investigations, people are safe and they interact with families and there are no red flags and there are no crises like this. This is fortunately rare, but incredibly overwhelming and just tragic when it does happen. So we have to stop and ask, what could we have done in training and in agency policy so that we're not talking about anymore of these tragedies? Yes, we're having many conversations. The department has asked us to be part of a group looking at this. We are looking at every possible scenario and tool and strategy, looking to our law enforcement colleagues for ideas. Often law enforcement, you know, they would over the years say, we don't go out by ourselves. And, or if we do go out, we have, you know, different tools at our disposal than DCFS has. I've been thinking about one of my experiences in particular, where I went somewhere early in my career and was having a conversation with the mom. The allegations involved a family member. So I'm in the home and having what was a pretty good conversation about something that's very hard to discuss with a family member when there's an allegation of child maltreatment. And as you're doing that, when you're engaged in that interaction and you're trying to create an opportunity to address something very important, I happen to be glancing around, taking in my surroundings as you're taught to do. And I glance up and I see a handgun on top of the refrigerator. And I'm by myself. So where does my mind go at that point? I'm there to discuss child maltreatment and allegations and protection. But in the moment, I'm trying to figure out if I'm safe and who else might be in the house because I hear people upstairs. So my emphasis should be on that child in that moment. But it is accurate to say I had multiple thoughts going through my mind in that moment. And I talked to my husband, who's retired law enforcement, about this thought the other day, and my son, who's a police officer. I said, what would you have done? And both of them, without hesitation, said they would have secured the weapon and they would have moved the family to another environment for a discussion to continue that interview. Well, DCFS doesn't have that authority, obviously. That far exceeds the authority out of the scope of their work. And I'm just kind of stuck there, Sean, thinking about that scenario. I was able to finish the interview and leave without any further issue. But we send people places where they have no sense of what they're encountering. They have very little sense. They have very little background often about what might be happening in an environment. So I say that to describe the uncertainty that comes with this work and the ways that we have to think very differently about worker safety. I think we are poised and prepared to have some really hard conversations about significant and meaningful change.
Some of the people I've grown up with ended up becoming law enforcement officers at different levels. And they always talk about what we've all heard, which is, you know, it's a difficult job. You're dealing with people on their worst day. Well, I actually think DCFS may be dealing with people on even more difficult circumstances, because you could be talking about removal of a child.
I mean, imagine the gravity of that. You know, you don't call ahead and say you're going to arrive at 2 o'clock. You arrive at someone's home unannounced with an allegation that may be unfounded, maybe total, you know, fabrication, but you're there nonetheless, because you have to find out if the allegation has validity, if there's evidence to support it. And, you know, a lot of times those cases are unfounded, but you're still on somebody's front porch. You're still asking to come inside their house with an allegation. And that is intrusive and incredibly overwhelming when you think about it. So knowledge is important, as much knowledge as we can provide, and the opportunity to not be in that situation alone. And that's what we're trying to think through at this point.
I hear a lot about the need for more money for DCFS, and certainly the need for more staffing.
Everything's on the table. I think it's fair to say that there are a lot of us who are having these conversations. We hope that if necessary, if they require funding, that those decisions will be supported. I think that they will be. I think the people that I have talked to who are in a position to make changes are open and receptive and willing to come together and really tackle this. I think it's clear that we're not going to leave that table until we have really explored all the potential strategies that could change that response. It honestly breaks our hearts to think that someone who goes through this training leaves and still has questions about their safety. For some, this work is a calling. They feel like it makes a difference in people's lives, and it can, and it does.
That's Betsy Goulet with the University of Illinois Springfield. She helps train DCFS caseworkers. Two Illinois caseworkers in recent years have died after being attacked while doing their jobs. Deidre Silas in December and Pam Knight in 2019. This is Statewide. Stay with us. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. The parent company of member station WBEZ is acquiring the Chicago Sun-Times. And as Dave McKinney reports, that deal will change the city's media landscape in a big way.
The Chicago Public Media Board voted unanimously to bring together two of the city's best-known journalism brands. Financial details remain unclear, but the Sun-Times will be turned into a nonprofit. Chicago Public Media's Matt Moog said foundations and a key investor in the Sun-Times, Michael Sachs, have stepped up to make the merger possible.
We will be able to create a sustainable source of revenue for local journalism in Chicago for the foreseeable future. And that's a really significant thing, the way different stakeholders here came together to preserve something that was important for the community.
The transaction will be completed at the end of January. This is Dave McKinney.
Well, as we march toward the two-year point in the COVID-19 pandemic, the headlines have become real life for many in Illinois. One Vermilion County family dealing with loss has now teamed up with the state in hopes of saving more lives. Pastor Ken McCray and his wife Renee pastored a church in Danville since the late 90s. Last May, the couple traveled to a wedding and ended up with COVID. Both were unvaccinated. Tanisha Spain recently talked with Pastor McCray about how his message has changed since his diagnosis.
Now, where you talked about being on the fence, is that kind of where you were, your family? Were you on the fence? Were you waiting to see how it was going to go? Where were you with regard to vaccines in May?
It was uncertainty. We knew it needed to be done, but I think every member of the family was like a little uneasy about the shot.
When Pastor Ken McCray and his wife Renee returned home from a wedding in May 2021, they both got sick and were isolating at home. Their conditions got worse, and days later, Ken called 911 for Renee. She was taken to the hospital, and when Pastor McRae tried to follow his wife to the ICU, a temperature check led to him being immediately admitted as well. 3 weeks later, Pastor McRae was strong enough to come home. His wife was not.
And so she was in ICU for 3 weeks. I was on the COVID side for 3 weeks. And then she colded, and they were able to bring her back. And then they took her over to Champaign and put her on the ECMO machine.
After being on the ECMO machine, also known as life support, for 38 days, Renee McRae died on July 11th. The couple shared 35 years of marriage and 3 children. McRae says they often talked about getting vaccinated, but didn't.
COVID has affected me personally as one who has contracted it and seen the devastation that it has and experienced.
Now he's working with the state of Illinois and the All In for Illinois ad campaign that aims to help people feel safe and comfortable about receiving the COVID-19 vaccine.
That it is a difference reading about somebody versus you are that somebody. So it resonated even more. It made it mandatory for my children when they got here. You must go get vaccinated now, because I could not bear seeing you go through what we're going through. And even with the congregation, encouragement, there's a little bit more conviction behind it now, yeah, in that process.
It's been more than 8 months, and McRae still has a cough and gets winded. He says telling the story doesn't get any easier, but he hopes sharing his story will help others move beyond the idea of getting vaccinated and actually do it.
With some people, it's a realization that they're not going to move. They're not going to budge. But for those who are on the fence, you know, it provides an opportunity to give them some tools and some information for consideration that can help move them to the other side.
Ken says being part of the state's ad campaign helped him work through his grief. He said he's also found comfort in hearing people share what an impact Renee has had on their spiritual life. I'm Tanisha Spain, Illinois Newsroom.
COVID-19 continues to produce challenges for nursing homes and retirement centers. Michelle O'Neill recently spoke with Ted Pappas. He's the CEO of Friendship Manor in the Quad Cities.
After dealing with the first year of COVID-19, Friendship Manor and many other nursing homes worked hard to encourage residents and employees to get vaccinated. Ted Pappas, CEO, says that's been successful. The nonprofit is in compliance with Illinois Governor Pritzker's vaccine mandate, with nearly 70% of staff vaccinated and more than 98% of residents vaccinated.
Because of the high vaccination rate of our residents and our high vaccination rate of our staff, we're seeing very mild or almost asymptomatic cases, which is good because, as we know, a year ago, we did not see that because of the fact we didn't have the vaccine immunity for our residents and staff.
Friendship Manor's most recent report on GuideStar says the financial impact has been devastating, a loss of $70,000 per month. And Pappas says the government seems to have completely forgotten nursing homes despite increased regulatory requirements and increased expenses.
But the funding in 2021 was very late and didn't cover truly the revenue and expenses that have been incurred. And quite frankly, I think you're going to see organizations struggle. I just was reading in Galesburg, Cottage Hospital is, you know, their clinics have filed for bankruptcy and they're having all kind of difficulty. And I think you're going to see a lot of that in the coming year.
Pappas also says he's disappointed with the lack of action by local government.
What was probably the most discouraging thing is that a lot of cities and counties received Recovery Act funds last spring, and a lot of those funds were to be diverted and used for not-for-profits and businesses to help them who have gone through what we've gone through. And there's been very little interest or priority to do anything with those funds other than we're going to study how to use them, which makes no sense because the guidelines are very clear that not-for-profits are to be helped. And certainly a not-for-profit nursing home, CCRC like Friendship Manor, should be helped. And we went twice to the city council and laid out our plea, and it went nowhere.
Friendship Manor and its residents have benefited from therapeutic treatments for COVID-19, such as monoclonal antibodies. One example is Regeneron. But Pappas says the government has stopped distributing the drug because studies show it's less effective against the Omicron variant.
What's troubling is we really don't know what variant our residents have. And what would be ideal is to be able to know very quickly, is it the Omicron or is it a different type of variant? Because you hate to just stop a therapeutic that could work for somebody that had a type of variant that it would work very well on. And to me, if you have a treatment available, give it to the person, because right now I don't know of any negative things that would happen. And if it happens to be a variant that will work, then you've really helped that resident or staff member.
Now the CEO says his biggest concern is running out of PPE and COVID-19 tests.
We're placing orders now that just aren't getting filled, and that is concerning, because your inventory is only going to last so long. Right now we do have what we need, but if we continue having to test and using the PPE in a month or so, we could be in real difficulty. And I think everyone's starting to feel that as well.
Over the past couple of months, the number of Friendship Manor staff and residents who've tested positive for COVID-19 has risen along with the rest of the Quad Cities.
With staff, we can test and test and test, but with families, you can't do that. And so you know a lot of facilities and our industry is concerned that with the Omicron, could it be coming in now with family members that it could be asymptomatic and you wouldn't know because you're not testing like you test your staff and residents.
I'm Michelle O'Neill.
Some states have scaled back contact tracing efforts. Side Effects Public Media's Steph Whiteside looks at the situation in southern Illinois, where many report confusion and a lack of guidance from health officials.
Jamie White and her younger sons tested positive for COVID a couple days before New Year's. When we talked the following week, she said she had yet to receive any calls or emails about what to do.
When I tried to reach the health department, I was told they're no longer doing contact tracing and was given a phone number to call, but that number never picks up.
It's a stark contrast to her husband and oldest son, who tested positive just a few days earlier. They were quickly connected with a contact tracer.
She sent paperwork telling, you have it, here's how long your quarantine is, this is when you're released.
Several local health departments in southern Illinois announced that the state's surge center would be taking over contact tracing by mid-January. In the meantime, many say they've been left without any guidance from anyone. Jeremy Rosine says his son got COVID around Christmas time, and it was night and day from his experience in 2020.
Because when I tested positive, I was bombarded. I remember getting multiple phone calls from the health department, different people contacting me, not realizing others had already done so, which is a stark contrast from what we've experienced recently, where I can't get a hold of anyone even when I'm the one making the effort.
Others I spoke with say they're confused about recent changes in the CDC's quarantine guidelines. Megan Jarrett says when she and her kids tested positive, she wasn't contacted until a full week later, after her isolation period had already ended. She's also been frustrated, trying to get documentation to prove to her boss that she was required to isolate and miss work.
If I don't have documentation, I can lose my job. And it's a terrifying, terrifying thought. That worries me because people could lose their livelihoods over this.
Turns out, Jarrett's local health department is no longer providing letters of documentation, and she's been unable to get a letter from the state or her physician. Bart Hagston is a public health administrator in Jackson County, Illinois. He says right now, several factors are creating a perfect storm.
The giant spike in cases of COVID, the state centralizing the contact tracing, the CDC changing the isolation and quarantine guidance, and testing, especially access to home tests, not being what it needs to be right now. So you've got all of these factors converging right now, making a pretty big mess, frankly.
A spokeswoman for the state health department said in an email that the surge in cases has made it difficult to circle back and issue documentation to people who need it, but the agency expects people to follow the CDC's latest isolation guidance. Jamie White, whose kids tested positive in late December, said she wasn't clear on when it would be safe for her family to be out in public again. They played it safe, but she's worried not everyone will do the same.
The more frustrating part is knowing that no one is receiving any guidance right now. So are people just kind of deciding for themselves when they should quarantine, or a time when maybe it would be really good to have guidance because everyone is testing positive and nobody's really sure what to do?
White says no one has asked her who she's been in contact with before she got sick, and the link she was sent told her to notify close contacts herself. State officials say with more than 200,000 cases a week, it's not possible to trace all close contacts. For now, they're prioritizing high-risk cases and people 65 and older. Local health officials say they're also triaging cases. I'm Steph Whiteside, Side Effects Public Media.
Side Effects Public Media is a regional reporting collaboration focused on public health. A year ago, a fresh nursing school graduate entered the field in the midst of a pandemic. Peter Medlin checked in with her again to see how it's gone a year into being a nurse during COVID-19.
Taylor Bolte says it feels like she's been a nurse for 10 years already.
I can't believe it's only been a year.
Way back in March of 2020, she was one of the many nursing students forced to leave in the middle of clinical shifts as hospitals braced for the first COVID surges and tried to preserve personal protection equipment or PPE. Now, she's found herself caught in the middle of yet another COVID wave as a full-time nurse at Swedish American Hospital in Rockford.
Every day is a complete whirlwind. It's like 12, 13, 14 hours of nonstop patient care, hardly sitting down, like running from room to room. It's exhausting mentally and physically, and I'm only 24, so.
Bolte's experience at Swedish American has been far different than she expected. She got the job after graduating from Lewis University, where she spent a good part of her senior year learning remotely.
Was initially hired for an orthopedic and neurology floor. Since our hospital and just our region in Rockford has been so full with COVID, we've just kind of had a sprinkle of every sort of patient. We have COVID patients. We have ICU transfers.
She has at least one COVID patient every shift.
And that's just because our COVID floor is completely full. Our ICU is completely full. And so we have nowhere for other, you know, patients to go.
Even though she was thrown into the field during a chaotic time, she says her education prepared her well.
Luckily, I had really, really good preceptors and amazing bosses that helped me to learn.
As she was finishing her degree in the fall of 2020, Bolte returned to the hospital where she had done her clinical work, and she saw nurses who were burnt out and almost immune to the death they saw so much. Since then, she's seen a lot of nurses leave the field entirely. She says that, in part, leads to really difficult staffing shortages.
We've had a lot of staff leave. I think our nursing CEO said we had like 64 travelers in our hospital right now, from nurses to tech.
Before those travel nurses came, Bolte says it was difficult to find a way to sit with her patients and talk to them.
It's been hard to carve out that special time to spend with them, which is so important right now because we're really the only people they see because we don't allow visitors in the hospital right now. And some people are here for months.
It's often overwhelming, she says, especially when it's hard to see an end to the pandemic. But she makes it clear her feelings about nursing haven't changed, and she's not leaving anytime soon.
Whether that's holding up a FaceTime call with a family member or kind of being the middleman between specialists and physicians to keep family updated with everything going on, holding patients' hands and praying over them.
Bolte says there's been plenty of venting and solidarity with her fellow nurses.
For the people that have been there, like for the long haul, it's definitely a bond that nobody really understands, like in other aspects of my life.
One thing that really helps her get through the day, there are always people who get better.
I mean, I had a patient the other day that went from 50 liters of high flow oxygen to just 5 liters on her nasal cannula overnight. And this was someone we didn't think was going to recover.
It's been a long first year for Bolte, one that, as she says, has often felt like 10. But right now, she says she's just hoping for an end in sight and that people don't lose trust in her and the rest of the healthcare field through the pandemic. I'm Peter Medlin.
Illinois lawmakers are aiming to build the tech industry here while keeping the revenue in state. State Senator Sarah Feigenholz says Apple and Google take up to 30% of the profits from app developers. The profit is then taxed in California rather than Illinois. The Chicago Democrat has introduced the Freedom to Subscribe Directly Act. She says it could increase Illinois' corporate income tax revenue by removing those fees.
if we assume Illinois is only 1% conservatively of all smartphone app sales nationwide, we are essentially exporting $1 billion in revenue from Illinois companies to these two California monopolies.
Under the plan, Illinois tech companies could keep the estimated $1 billion in fees for themselves. Feigenholz says she expects bipartisan support. There's more to come on Statewide. Stay with us. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. The onset of the pandemic sparked new business ventures for some. The forced isolation made one Northern Illinois couple look at a business idea that incorporates an old-fashioned way of communicating. Yvonne Booz has that story.
These days, most people use social media to communicate with close friends and family. Oswego residents Lo Bannerman Dennis and her husband Stephen wanted to make connecting more intimate with the help of the U.S. Postal Service. They did this by creating a greeting card company called Positive Post Co. Dennis says when she was growing up, greeting cards were always big in her family.
I was raised in a family where you couldn't play with a gift until you wrote and sent the thank you note. Yes. And every holiday was celebrated with some kind of a tangible card. So birthdays, greeting cards, literally anything.
She says she wanted to share that feeling that she had as a young girl with everyone else. The couple has a 2-year-old who turned 1 at the beginning of 2020. Dennis says she realized that a lot of her friends who weren't parents didn't know how to support her. One of her friends gave her a pack of cards that had encouraging words on them, and she wanted to create something similar for new parents. This was the thought before COVID-19 took over.
And then the pandemic hit, and I was like, oh, there's a bigger need here. It's not just moms and new families. There's a global need for connection and love.
Dennis calls herself a pollinator of happiness. She's a dietitian and lactation counselor who pulled the self-made title from what she calls her need to help heal people holistically. The couple started reaching out to friends and family during the beginning of the pandemic. They did this by sending photo cards of their daughter, Spud, around her birthday. Dennis says she thought they would get responses back since most people were home. Months went by and they still weren't hearing anything. So they reached out to see why. They learned that people were more comfortable with using social media to communicate and didn't want to deal with the hassle of buying postage stamps.
So we try to create images that are happy and joyful, but also ones that are there when someone needs a hug and they're going through a harder time and you might not know the words to say. And then it's all on 100% recycled paper and the postage stamp is already on it.
The couple started with 8 designs. 2 had fun messages. Others were meant for hard times, but were sprinkled with upbeat messages. Dennis says she knows there are plenty of greeting card companies out there, but she compares them to commercial food.
When food is grown on a conventional farm or it's grown in your backyard, you can 100% taste the difference. And same thing when you cook it. You can tell when food is just microwaved or when it's cooked with love. And so that's kind of the difference I see here too.
She says the images on their notes are hand-drawn and she touches every single card that goes out. She originally outsourced an artist, but has discovered that she has a talent for drawing too. She says Positive Post Co. will continue to find other avenues that will help drive positivity and light into the world. Dennis says she carried a lot of doubt when it came to her own artistry, but she is encouraging others to drop any burdens that are holding them down.
And if you're listening and you're questioning how to show up in the world, or you have a little inkling of a business idea or even a hobby, passion, anything, please follow it. You never know where it's going to lead. There aren't any failures, even if you start something and you don't continue it.
She explains that there is always a lesson learned, which can lead to a greater purpose. I'm Yvonne Booz.
Abandoned mines are scattered across 76 of Illinois' 102 counties, and sites mined prior to 1977 weren't bound by most of the regulations shuttering mining operations face today. That means older mines in particular left environmental contamination and other hazards in their wake. As Tim Shelley learned in an interview with the Prairie Rivers Network's Amanda Pancaw, the Illinois Abandoned Mine Land Reclamation Program is getting a shot in the arm from the federal infrastructure bill.
the Illinois Department of Natural Resources does maintain a Illinois coal mine map online that anybody can get on. It's an interactive GIS map that's accessible to the public, where you can get on, and many of the sites, there's additional information listed showing the amount of money that's going to be needed to clean up that site. Many of these sites are privately owned. We also know that there are a lot of abandoned mine sites out there that aren't identified yet, that aren't in this state and national register. And so that's something, as we reconsider funding for the program moving forward into the future, we need to be making sure that inventory also gets up to date, and educating the public, which is a big part of what I want to do at Prairie Rivers Network, is ensuring that community members, community leaders are aware that these sites are all across the state and that many of them are uninventoried and many of them are causing environmental problems.
Yeah. So, and I think when coal is sold, there's a fee that's collected that's supposed to go towards rehabilitating these abandoned mine sites. And it's my understanding that fee collection had expired in September, but now it's been renewed again. Can you explain a little more about the status of that?
Yeah, so when Congress passed SMCRA, the law in 1977, they established the Abandoned Mine Lands Program, which is funded by a fee on every ton of coal mine. So it's called the AML Trust Fund. And that fee was collected on mine coal up until September of 2021, when the collection of that fee expired. So that's something we had, Prairie Rivers Network had been advocating for the last few years, was the reauthorization of the collection of that fee. So that got rolled into the bipartisan infrastructure package that passed this fall. So the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act will reauthorize the fee to fund that program moving forward. And then the other big news is that infrastructure bill also authorizes an additional $11.3 billion into the state and AML programs over the next 15 years to give that program a boost. Illinois is really set to benefit greatly from that one-time boost. So Illinois is expected to see $1.3 billion over the next 15 years just from that single investment, in addition to the money we'll receive from the trust fund.
What kind of things might this money be used for? What impacts might we actually see on some of these abandoned mine sites?
Priority sites are typically the ones that are an imminent harm to public safety or environmental safety. So like a mine shaft that somebody could fall down, a high wall that is steep. Those types of things are going to be prioritized. And that's really what the agency has focused on in the, 50 plus year history of the program. So this money will, will continue to do those priority one sites. There's also priority two and three sites. So with the influx of money, we'll hopefully see more of those sites start to be addressed.
So I know we have a couple parks even around here in Peoria that have, former coal mining sites that have been converted into parkland, trails or something of that nature. Is that ultimately one of the things we can do to repurpose this land once we rehabilitate it? What can we do with this old abandoned mine land?
Yeah, that's a great question, and a question that I love to answer, because part of this is not just about cleaning up the environmental impact of these sites. It's about giving communities land back that they can use for economic development. So, there are wineries located on abandoned mine lands, the Sparta Shooting Complex. There are community soccer fields. Plenty of state parks. So these properties can be a future source of investment, economic opportunity for communities. I think of communities in Macoupin County where there's a lot of farmland, and farmland's expensive. So we can reclaim abandoned mine lands and have maybe a cheaper property for opportunities, and where we're not taking farmland out of production. So that's, really exciting part of this to me is reclaiming those sites, giving the community the land back for future development. Who knows what it could be.
That's Amanda Pankow of the Prairie Rivers Network. She spoke with Tim Shelley about abandoned mine land reclamation. A group dedicated to preserving railroad history has bought a historic rail property in the Quad Cities. Railroading Heritage of Midwest America now owns 90 acres in Silvis that was once the main car shop for the Rock Island Line. Herb Trix has more.
President Steve Sandberg says his group, now based in Minneapolis, plans to use the Silvis complex to restore antique equipment and may eventually open a museum.
We love the trains. We enjoy the trains. But it's really because of our enjoyment of preservation and history and teaching generations about the hard work that, the men and women did before us to build this country.
His group bought the property from National Railway Equipment, which is moving its locomotive manufacturing and most of its workers to southern Illinois and Kentucky. Three railroads also now use the complex in Silvis, the BNSF, Canadian Pacific, and Iowa Interstate. He calls this one of the boldest moves for historic and railroad preservation in recent history. I'm Herb Trix.
The federal government uses scores of programs to give tens of billions of dollars a year to help rural America, but the USDA alone has more than a dozen definitions of rural, depending on the program. Harvest Public Media's Jonathan All reports that can leave some very small towns out of the process.
Houston, Missouri is in the Ozarks, not far from the Arkansas border. It's a town of about 2,500, with a claim to fame of being the hometown of famous clown Emmett Kelly and an annual festival named in his memory. Houston City Administrator Scott Avery was looking for ways to bring high-speed internet to town.
There's a federal grant that I was looking at with the broadband. There's a ton of federal grants. One of them defines rural as more than 100 miles from a metro area. Well, I'm less than 100 air miles from Springfield, so I don't qualify.
The Springfield, Missouri metro area has about 500,000 people. It's an hour and 40-minute drive from Houston on two-lane roads, but only 90 miles as the crow flies. So for that grant, this small town with a quarter of its residents under the poverty line wasn't rural enough. About an hour north in Rolla, Missouri, it's a different story.
I'm on the pedestrian overpass above Interstate 44 at one of the four exits into Rolla. Right ahead of me is Phelps Health. It's a big hospital with its own cancer center. Off to the left, Missouri S&T. It's a high-tech research institution with 6,000 students. But this town of 20,000, it's more than 100 miles away from Springfield and St. Louis. So according to that broadband grant, this is rural.
When I look at the city of Rolla, I don't think it meets the definition, any of the definitions, of rural.
Lou Magnitz is the mayor of Rolla. He spends a lot of time telling people about Rolla's big city-like amenities, its airport, numerous manufacturing plants, and high-tech sector. And while his city didn't apply for that particular broadband grant that Houston was shut out of, Magnitz doesn't shy away from grants intended to help small towns.
If a grant come down and it was tied to rural, I would probably self-justify it and by saying, look, the Rolla and its periphery probably could meet that definition.
The definition of rural can take into account population, population density, distance from a big city, and even the percentage of people that travel into a metro area to work. But there's no single definition. That's what has some towns and counties frustrated. Having all those definitions isn't all bad, according to some rural advocates. Bonnie Prigge heads the Merrimack Regional Planning Commission, which works with eight counties in Missouri the commission calls rural. She says the multiple definitions can be frustrating, but if there was only one, some places would be cut out all the time.
Right now, with the different definitions, there might be other grants that we could look at that they could qualify for. And if we had one single definition, then there may not be a grant to address that issue.
That's cold comfort for Scott Avery. While he does apply for and gets grants targeted for rural America, he and his staff of two don't have the time to chase after opportunities, only to find his rural town isn't rural enough.
When we're looking at these communities and we're comparing them, one size doesn't fit all is true, but at the same time, why can't we make sure the systems are working everywhere?
Avery says instead of treating rural America as a place that can be defined by mileage and population rules, it should be defined by the communities that have similar problems and need help. That's the approach Ann Morrison-Smith takes. She works for the Missouri Department of Economic Development and says helping rural areas would be easier if they aren't treated like a monolith.
We find the fingerprint of each community and how it works and conducts itself to be so unique to itself. And and our communities take such pride in that.
But changing the structure of economic development won't be easy, and neither will clarifying the definitions of what's rural and what's not. Former Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue said he wanted a standard definition of rural in the 2018 Farm Bill, but that didn't make the final version. And that's just one federal agency with numerous definitions of what's small and remote enough to be called rural. Jonathan All, Harvest Public Media.
That's all the time we have for Statewide this week. We're glad you could be with us, and be sure to join us next time. We'll have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Remember, all of our episodes can be found at nprillinois.org. Just look for Statewide, and our weekly podcast is available through the NPR One app. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.